There's a lot of pressure to wear the right clothes for every situation, but the clothes don't make the man. With Mack Weldon, you can build a wardrobe that looks polished in any setting and tells the world you stay you wherever you go. Go to MackWeldon.com and get 25% off your first order of $125 or more with promo code MACK25. That's MACKWELDON.com. Promo code MACK25.
Hello and welcome back, everyone, to another episode of Crime with Holly. It's your girl, Holly, and I am back today with another solved murder case for you guys. I don't have any kind of case updates to give you guys, so we are just going to get straight to business. But before we get into the details of today's case, I do just want to give you a bit of a warning because this case does contain details of sexual assault and murder of an 11-year-old girl. I know child cases can be hard for some, but I do think that they are just as important to share. So if you skip this episode, I will not have any kind of hard feelings at all. I totally understand, and I just wanted to give you guys a fair warning. So without further ado, today's episode is on the murder of Carly Brucia. Carly Jane Brucia was born on March 16, 1992, in Oyster Bay on the North Shore of Long Island, New York. She was born to her parents Joe and Susan. Not long after she was born, her parents got a divorce and Susan moved herself and Carly to Sarasota, Florida. Susan would go on to remarry a man named Stephen, and the two of them would have a son of their own. At 11 years old, Carly was your typical preteen. She loved most girly things. She loved to roller skate, be around her friends, and she had dreams of becoming a pop star. Her favorite singer at the time was Jennifer Lopez, and she wanted to be just like her. Carly was the type of girl who would give her friends big hugs whenever she saw them, and she was so loving and caring. Carly hated to see people down or hurt, and she would do whatever she could to make people smile. She also had a cat that she adored named Charlie. Carly attended McIntosh Middle School, where she was well-liked by all of her peers. Her teacher said that she was just this shining light and was beyond polite to all of the teachers and her classmates. Carly was also active in the school's choir. As I mentioned earlier, Carly and her mother moved to Sarasota, Florida, and her father stayed in New York. And despite the distance, she remained close to her father and the rest of her family there. Carly would spend her breaks from school at her father's house, and that included Christmas break. In the Investigation Discovery show See No Evil, Carly's aunts talked about how much she was just so loved by all of the family in New York, and how whenever Carly would go there to visit for the holidays, she was always so spoiled and doted on, but in a good way. Home videos show a smiling and happy Carly interacting with her family, and you could just tell that she loved being surrounded by her father and her aunts. And these home videos and memories are what her family clings to now, because it was after her last holiday visit in 2003 that their lives would forever be changed. February 1st, 2004 was a day that many people remember for various different reasons. It was Super Bowl Sunday, and the New England Patriots defeated the Carolina Panthers in a thrilling 32-29 win. That year, Budweiser had a memorable commercial of a donkey becoming a Clydesdale horse, and Pepsi had an ad that featured Beyoncé, Pink, and Britney Spears. That Super Bowl also had the infamous halftime show where Justin Timberlake exposed Janet Jackson's breast on live television in what they called a wardrobe malfunction. For Carly's family, though, it would be a day that would change the trajectory of their entire lives. The night before Super Bowl Sunday, Carly stayed over at her friend Danielle's house, and the plan was to spend Sunday with them watching the game. But around 6 p.m., about 30 minutes before kickoff, Carly had a change of heart. She told Danielle and Danielle's mom, Connie, that she was going to walk home to spend time with her mom. Apparently, she confided in them that Susan and her stepfather, Stephen, had been fighting more frequently, and she was feeling pretty down about it. She wanted to go home to spend time with her mom and just be there for her. Carly said her goodbyes and walked out of the house sometime around 6:15 p.m. and began the one-mile walk home. Connie called Susan just to let her know that, hey, Carly said that she was going to walk home. She said it was fine, but I wanted to let you know. After hanging up with Connie, Susan sent her husband Stephen to drive up the road to pick up Carly because she was worried about Carly walking along the Bee Ridge Road, which is a pretty heavily traveled road. But as Stephen drove the short distance between their home and the home where Carly had spent the night at, he couldn't find his stepdaughter anywhere. He called Susan several times as he made the drive back and forth, trying to figure out where she could have gone. The longer he drove up and down looking for Carly, the more frantic he became. Stephen went back to the house, and by this point, it had been an hour since anyone had last seen Carly. Susan immediately called 911 to report her daughter as missing, and I have that call, so I'm going to play it for you guys.
911, what's the location of the emergency?
My daughter is missing.
What's your address, ma'am?
She's gone. We can't find her anywhere. I've called all her friends.
How old is she?
11.
Okay, what's her name, ma'am?
Carly, C-A-R-L-I-E.
And last name?
The Sarasota Sheriff's Office immediately responded to the home, and when they arrived, they found a very distraught Susan. She was beside herself and sick with worry. This was so unlike Carly. She was never one to walk off and not let anyone know where she was going to be. And thankfully, the police jumped in and began their investigation. They first started with Carly's friend Danielle and her mom Connie. They wanted to know if Carly had said anything while at home or if she mentioned meeting up with anyone. Both Danielle and her mother said that overall Carly seemed fine, but she had been a little bit down about the fact that her mom and stepfather had been fighting. They told police that that was the reason why Carly decided to go home early. After speaking with Danielle and Connie, police began going door to door to see if any of the neighbors had seen Carly. And Susan and other investigators began calling all of Carly's friends to see if they had heard from her. And of course, none of them had. The police continued their efforts, searching everywhere that they could think of, and by 3 a.m., everyone was exhausted and had done everything that they could in that moment. Investigators, Carly's friends, and family were all hopeful that the following day she would show up at school like nothing happened, and that she would come clean that she had been hiding out at a friend's. But in her mind, Susan knew that her daughter wasn't going to show up to school. She knew that that wasn't like Carly, the responsible and reliable young girl. And she was absolutely sick thinking about the endless possibilities of where her daughter could be and who she could be with. Susan was living every mother's worst nightmare. I am sure as the minutes ticked by, they felt like eternity. And come morning, whatever little fraction of hope that she may have been harboring was squashed when it was revealed that Carly did not show up for school. Investigators knew that they had to kick things into high gear and continue their efforts to find her.
Hey there, are you sitting down? Good, because Wayfair's biggest sale of the season is here and you can shop it right from your couch. It's Wayfair's Black Friday in July sale, and it's on now. Right now, you can score up to 80% off everything home at Wayfair. Snag outdoor furniture and decor at up to 60% off. Get area rugs for every room at up to 80% off. And refresh your sleep space with up to 60% off bedroom furniture. Plus, score amazing doorbuster deals and 24-hour surprise flash deals. And get it all with fast and free shipping on everything. Yep, even the big stuff. Right to your door. These are Wayfair's lowest prices of the summer. And did we mention they only last 5 days? So don't wait. Head to Wayfair.com today to score up to 80% off Wayfair's biggest sale of the season before it fizzles out. Shop Wayfair's Black Friday and July sale now through July 28th, only at Wayfair.com.
Wayfair, every style, every home.
On the morning of February 2, 2004, 11-year-old Carly Brucia had been missing for roughly 12 hours. Everyone was hopeful that she would show up to school, but when she didn't, police brought in bloodhounds to try and track her scent. Using Carly's pillowcase from her bedroom, police let the bloodhounds loose near Danielle's home, where Carly had left to walk home. The dogs tracked her scent down Bee Ridge Road, and as they approached a car wash, they continued to track her scent at an angle through the parking lot and around the back of the car wash towards a side street. This side street would have been a shortcut to Carly's home. However, the dogs stopped just short of this road. It was apparent that the dogs had lost her scent, likely meaning that Carly had gotten into a car and was driven away from the parking lot. With this information, police started to talk to the local businesses along the route that Carly took to see if anyone had seen or heard anything that day. They also started canvassing the area for surveillance cameras in hopes that one of these places had caught Carly on CCTV. They were happy to see that the car wash itself had several surveillance cameras on all sides of the building, but were they working was the big question. After getting into contact with the owners of the car wash, they found that all of the cameras on the property were motion activated and fully functioning on that Sunday afternoon, which I have to say, that is quite a miracle in and of itself. We often see these stories where surveillance cameras are found, but lo and behold, they're either malfunctioning, broken, or they were just decoy cameras. But in Carly's case, they were fully functioning, and investigators were eager to see the footage. Investigators had a general time of about 6:20 p.m. that would place Carly near the car wash. They queued up the first camera, but on it, it only showed the empty parking lot and the busy main road. The second camera was angled towards the entrance of the car wash, and it too showed nothing. The third and final camera that was located at the back of the car wash had been activated by motion at 6:21 p.m. In the video, you can see a young girl wearing jeans and a red shirt with a pink backpack slung over her shoulder. This is exactly what Carly had been described as wearing when she was last seen leaving her friend Danielle's house. In the frame, though, Carly was not alone. While Carly is walking towards the camera, a man appears at the bottom of the frame walking towards her. In the footage, you can see him approach Carly and stop right in front of her. He grabs onto her arm. The two exchange a few words before the man turns towards the camera, still gripping Carly's arm, and begins walking away with her. When you slow the video down, you can see as Carly is walking and she notices the man. It appears that she obviously doesn't want to engage with this man, so she looks down and fiddles with her Walkman that she was listening to music on, all while he's still walking towards her. He then latches onto her arm. He is saying something, but in slow motion, you can see him reach into his pocket. The video is a little grainy, but it does appear that he pulls something out of his pocket and possibly threatens her with it. They then turn towards the camera and walk out of view. When the video is slowed down, you can see that the man appears to be a white male with dark hair, and he's got a stocky build with tattoos on his forearms. And he's wearing a uniform of some sort that is consistent with what a mechanic or a tow truck driver would wear. His uniform also has a name tag on it, but the footage was too grainy to make out much detail about it. But from what you could see of it, it does look like the name that is on there had to be a three-letter name, So like Bob, Tom, Joe, and so on. With this footage in hand, police knew this was urgent, and they started zeroing in on people to question further and check their alibis. They brought Steven, Carly's stepfather, in to ask him questions about what he had been doing on the day that Carly went missing. He told them everything that he had before. He had been at home waiting for the football game to start with his wife, Susan. Susan had received a call that Carly was walking home down Bee Ridge Road, and she asked Steven to go pick her up. He left the house to go get her, but he couldn't find her. He told them about the repeated phone calls that he made to Susan asking where she was and telling her that he couldn't find her. And police were able to check his cell phone records to show that his story was true. But then Steven told the police something that really piqued their interest. He said that while he was out searching relentlessly for Carly, he had spotted a red tow truck driving around almost aimlessly. It had been going up and down Bee Ridge Road, and it even turned into the car wash parking lot several times. And this entire thing stuck out as odd to Steven. I think his senses were on high alert at this point, looking for his stepdaughter because he was in a panic. A couple times the truck seemed to slow down and look at Steven, and Carly's mother Susan had also been walking Bee Ridge Road around this time too, trying to find her daughter. And it seemed like the truck slowed down when driving by her as well, before taking off again. Just super odd behavior that Steven noticed. At some point, Steven and Susan went back over to Carly's friend's house to check to see if maybe she had gone back there. They were shocked to find that the red tow truck that had been driving up and down Bee Ridge Road had been parked in the driveway of Danielle's house. Come to find out, the owner of the truck was a man named Ron, a three-letter name, and he lived at Carly's friend's house. When police pulled his driver's license photo, they were shocked to find that he resembled the man in the footage. He also had dark hair and a stocky build. With having a three-letter name, being a tow truck driver that wears a uniform similar to the man in the footage, resembling the dude in surveillance, and the odd behavior right after she went missing, police knew immediately that they needed to speak to him. Ron said that he had spent the night Saturday evening at the house with the girls. While he slept in the other room, he said that he could hear them all night long laughing and being giddy. Sunday morning, he said that he woke up and got ready for work and left the house. He said that he hadn't seen Carly that morning before leaving for work, and when asked about what he had been wearing, he said that he was wearing a Super Bowl t-shirt. Investigators showed him a still shot of Carly and the man outside of the car wash to him and asked him who the man was. Ron said that he didn't know, but it definitely wasn't him, even though it did look like him. So Ron acknowledged that the man resembled him. The interrogators pressed a little bit harder and told him straight up that the investigators that he had spoken to the night before when Carly was first reported missing believed that the man in the footage was him. He again denied it was him and said that they can do whatever they needed to do to eliminate him, and he encouraged them to check with his work about his whereabouts. When asked about being seen driving down Bee Ridge Road in a suspicious manner, Ron did admit that he had been driving the tow truck around, but it wasn't for any nefarious reasons. Ron said that when Susan had called Connie and said that they couldn't find Carly, he went out to help look for her as well. Investigators left Ron in the interrogation room and quickly made their way to his place of employment to check his alibi, and they found that Ron was being truthful. He was, in fact, at work when Carly was abducted. After a search warrant was executed on Ron's tow truck and they came up with nothing placing Carly inside of it, Ron was ruled out as being involved. Susan was brought in and shown the video of the man with Carly to see if she could recognize him, and she too didn't know who he was. And let me just say, I cannot fathom the emotions and the heartbreak that Susan must have felt watching the video of her daughter being taken by this strange man. Putting myself in her shoes, I just couldn't imagine holding myself together long enough to even watch this video. And then to forever have this video ingrained in my mind of my child's last seconds, just wanting to reach through the screen and save them and protect them and tell them to run, there are just no words. And I am so deeply saddened that everyone that loves Carly had to watch this knowing that she was still missing and out there somewhere. The community was in shock that this young girl was just taken in broad daylight as cars passed by and nobody saw anything. In a sense, it kind of reminds me of the Kelsey Smith case that I recently covered. Kelsey had been abducted from Target in broad daylight and no one saw or heard anything. Carly's case and Kelsey's and many others for that matter are a grim reminder that evil is lurking at all times of the day and they aren't just hiding in the shadows. You truly can never let your guard down and it's terrifying to know that we are passing these people with ill intent daily unbeknownst to us. The news stations began sharing Carly's story, and police provided them the footage of Carly being abducted in hopes that someone would recognize this man. There was also a $25,000 reward that was being offered for information leading to an arrest, and it wasn't long before the story became national news. People in Sarasota hung flyers and did their part trying to find Carly. And the police were working on very little sleep trying to hunt down this man and hopefully do so fast enough to find Carly alive. Investigators went back over those surveillance cameras, repeatedly scouring them for anything that they may have missed. One thing that stuck out to them was a light yellow 1992 Buick Century station wagon that pulled into the parking lot 3 minutes before Carly was abducted. It can then be seen turning out of the parking lot and traveling down B Ridge Road and then turning on to a street behind the car wash. This obviously was someone they wanted to talk to. Unfortunately, though, the license plate on this car wasn't visible in the video. Now, as I said earlier, the news outlets were spreading Carly's story and the footage of her and this unidentified male. And police were being flooded with tips, thankfully, and they had to follow up on each and every one of them. 48 hours had gone by and still no sign of Carly. On the morning of February 3rd, police received a call from someone claiming that they knew the man in the video. They said that this man was his business partner and that he knew without a doubt that it was him. From the way that he walked, the way he moved, the uniform he wore, and the name tag on that uniform that he claimed read the name Joe. He knew without a shadow of a doubt that the man in this video was a man named Joseph Smith. Now, let me take a second to give you a quick little rundown on Joseph Smith and his background. According to the Ledger, Joseph Smith had been arrested at least 13 times between 1993 and 2004 when all of this took place. Most of his charges were for drug offenses, but he did have 2 charges for committing violence against women. In one of those cases, he was actually charged with kidnapping a 20-year-old woman, but he was later acquitted. In the other case against a different woman, he pleaded no contest. In this case, a woman claimed that Joseph had hit her in the face with a motorcycle helmet. He was sentenced to only 60 days in county jail for that. Joseph's only prison time that he spent was 17 months for drug possession and fraud. When detectives pulled up Joseph Smith's record, they found that he was currently on probation and that he had recently violated those terms of his probation, but he was not punished for doing so like he should have been. Detectives also learned that he drove a brown Lincoln car. When scouring the surveillance footage once again, searching for a brown Lincoln on any of those cameras from the car wash, detectives found nothing. Nowhere in any of the camera angles was his car. Despite not having his car on cameras, police knew that they needed to speak to him anyways because more calls were coming in saying that he looked like the guy in the video with Carly. They went to his home and Joseph Smith answered the door and willingly allowed them to walk inside. Investigators sat down with him for 45 minutes to talk. They asked him where he was during the Super Bowl and he said that he had been at home with his landlord, Mimi. Joseph rented a room from Mimi and her husband, Jeff. Detectives tell Joseph that they're investigating the abduction of an 11-year-old girl, and they showed him the picture from the surveillance cameras at the car wash. Joseph picks it up, he looks at it, and simply says that it does look like him, but it's not. Detectives ask if they could do a search of his room, and he agrees, allowing them full access to look around. They found nothing linking him to Carly, but they did, however, find, hanging in his closet, two mechanics' uniforms with a yellow name tape that read Joe. Joseph also allowed the authorities to search his car, and inside they again found nothing linking him to Carly. But they did find drug paraphernalia, and he was arrested for violating his probation and for having these items. Before they left the home, Joe's landlord, Mimi, came home, and they asked her about Joe's whereabouts on that Sunday. She told them the same story. He had been at the house with her watching the Super Bowl until about halftime. When the investigators left the house, they were thinking that maybe he wasn't their guy after all, but all of that would change later that evening. On the evening of February 3rd, 2004, at around 7 p.m., Joseph Smith's landlord Mimi and her husband Jeff went to the police station to speak to detectives. And what were they driving to the police station, you may ask? They were driving their light yellow Buick station wagon. According to Jeff, when Mimi had spoken to detectives earlier in the day, she had her times mixed up, and they were there to clarify what happened on Super Bowl Sunday. Jeff said that his wife had been babysitting their grandchild and had been distracted and wasn't able to fully pay attention to what time it was and what Joseph had been doing. Jeff said that Joseph approached him asking to borrow his car really quickly. Jeff agreed and asked how long he would be gone, and Joseph said that he would be gone for about 15 minutes or so. Detectives asked Jeff what Joseph had been wearing when he left the house, and he said that he was wearing his mechanic suit. When asked to describe the suit, Jeff said it was a two-piece suit with gray pants, gray top, and a yellow patch. Jeff also said that Joseph never returned that night with his car. At 6:30 a.m. the following morning, he woke up and found that the car was still gone. But come 7:30 a.m., Joe arrived back at the house giving the keys to Jeff. Detectives asked what Joe looked like when he showed up Monday morning at 7:30 a.m., and Jeff said that Joe looked really clean, like he had a good night's sleep, he looked happy, and like he had a good night out on the town. But when Jeff went to get inside of his car, he noticed that things were not the way he had left it. It was very clear that something had happened inside of the car because things had been moved around and the back seat of the car had been laid down when previously it was put up. Jeff said that after seeing the news, the fact that Joe borrowed the car and didn't return until the following day, and his behavior after, not to mention the man in the video looking strikingly like his tenant, he just knew that something wasn't right. Jeff fully cooperated with police and allowed them to do a forensic search of the car. Thank God for Jeff because he really helped shift the focus back to Joseph. Since Joseph was already in custody for probation violations, authorities brought him in for a formal interrogation. They read him his Miranda rights and he asked for a lawyer and refused to answer any of their questions. And this was frustrating for detectives because they still didn't know where Carly was, and they were still holding out hope that she was being held captive somewhere, even though they had a strong feeling that she wouldn't be found alive. The following day, February 4th, Joseph's brother John showed up to the police station, saying on February 1st, his brother, whom he didn't talk to much because they were estranged, called him out of the blue around 8 p.m., but John didn't pick up. He said it was the next day that he and his girlfriend had been watching the news when he saw the surveillance footage of Carly's abduction and knew it was his brother in the video. John said that at 11 p.m., Joseph showed up out of the blue to his house, and he refused to let him in because he had made his girlfriend and her teen daughter uncomfortable. John said that he noticed that Joe had been wearing his mechanic's uniform, but he was wearing boots as well, which that wasn't typically what he wore in his uniform. John told police that he felt certain that his brother was in the footage. According to the New York Post, it would also later be reported that on February 2nd, Joe arrived at work the next morning late, and he had been acting strangely. He kept washing his hands over and over, even though they were clean. And he also told his boss that he might have to leave the state at any time. Police knew that they needed to get Joseph to confess so that they could find Carly, and they told John if he speaks with him and says anything to let them know. On February 5th, Joseph spoke for over an hour to his brother and mom. John said that he felt like his brother was close to cracking, but he didn't give any details. But later that night, John would call the authorities once again, but this time he had details to give. John admitted that he had withheld information and that Joseph had, in fact, gave him a confession. According to John, he didn't believe the confession at first, and that was why he didn't tell the authorities what was said. But after thinking on it for some time, he decided to go ahead and hand that information over. Which, let me just say, this kind of pissed me off because who are you to decide whether someone is lying or not? Especially when there is a missing child on the line. Hand the dang information over and let them figure it out. And come to find out, after doing a little bit of research, John himself is not an outstanding dude either. And at the time all of this was going down, he had 3 felony convictions and had pending charges with the state's attorney's office. So clearly, homeboy is not the brightest bulb in the box. But he gave authorities the address of 6221 Proctor Road, which is the address of the Central Church of Christ. This church was located off I-75, and come to find out, the night of February 1st, the night that Carly had been abducted, at about 10 p.m., local cops had a run-in with Joseph Smith. According to the New York Post, patrolling cops spotted a Buick station wagon parked illegally under an overpass off I-75. While standing there looking the car over, out comes Joseph Smith from some thick underbrush. They asked him what he was doing, and he said that he had to go pee, and the cops let him go. But he really wasn't actually peeing, obviously, and Carly was found under some thick underbrush not far from where Joseph had emerged from. When they finally found Carly's body behind the church at around 1 a.m., she was found nude from the waist down, minus a singular sock that was left on her right foot. They also found that Carly had a deep ligature wound to her neck. John told the authorities that Joseph had said that he had taken what he thought was cocaine on the day that he abducted her, and that everything else was a blur. Joseph would eventually admit to sexually assaulting Carly in the station wagon and admitted that he had violently raped her. The medical examiner determined that Carly had been drugged into the field behind the church and that she had been strangled from behind. They also found markings around both wrists, which were consistent with being bound. Semen was also found on Carly's shirt, which would later be identified as belonging to Joseph Smith. When the forensic testing of the Buick was completed, they had recovered 2 hairs that belonged to Carly, and 7 fibers from Carly's red shirt had also been found, placing Carly without a doubt inside that 1992 Buick station wagon that Joseph Smith had borrowed from his landlord. When officers gave the horrible news to Carly's mother that she had been found deceased, she broke down crying and screaming that he killed her baby. When the community learned what had happened to Carly, they all mourned for the loss of such a beautiful and young girl. They all rallied together once more to lay flowers where Carly was found at the church and held vigils and offered their condolences to the grieving family. Those within the community really showered this family with so much love and support, and I'm sure that it meant so much to those who loved Carly. A memorial service was held for Carly on February 10th, and many people attended, including those who worked long, tireless hours searching for Carly. They were deeply impacted by this tragedy, and that's something that we don't think about often enough, what those working these cases go through as well. There is a thing called secondary post-traumatic stress disorder, or secondary PTSD, and it's something I learned about in one of my classes for my bachelor's in criminology and criminal justice. But secondary PTSD impacts police officers, first responders, lawyers, and even doctors who have been exposed to some of the worst things imaginable. So not only does my heart go out to Carly's family, but those who worked on her case round the clock trying to bring her home. On February 20th, 2004, Joseph Smith was officially charged with kidnapping, one count of sexual battery, and first-degree murder. Florida is a death penalty state, and prosecutors were fully ready to fight for the maximum penalty. While Joseph was awaiting trial, he tried to send a letter written in code to his brother John, but was intercepted at the jail. A cryptanalyst forensic examiner from the FBI lab in Quantico broke the code, and it read, quote, "I wish I had something juicy to say. Oh, okay. The backpack and clothes were in four different dumpsters. I left it out in the open. I dragged the body to where it was found. Destroy this after deciphering it, and shut up." A month before the trial was set to begin, lawyers attempted to get the car wash video thrown out. His lawyer argued that it could not be proven that the date and timestamps on the video were authentic. They also tried to fight for the confession that Joseph had given his brother to be thrown out as well. But ultimately, these motions were denied. At the trial, the prosecutors did an incredible job detailing all of the damning evidence against Joseph. And every day, Carly's family and friends sat in the courtroom listening to all of the horrific details. Prosecutors believe that when Joseph borrowed the car from his landlord, he left to go do an array of drugs. While he was driving down Bee Ridge Road, he had spotted Carly walking home and decided that he wanted to kidnap her. He drove into the parking lot of the car wash before pulling back out onto Bee Ridge Road and turning down the street located just behind the car wash, where they believe that he parked the car and got out and approached Carly, grabbing her arm and leading her back to the Buick station wagon, and then drove off to commit the sexual assault and murder somewhere else. The jury came back with a guilty verdict, and they voted 10-2 for the death penalty. On March 6, 2006, Circuit Judge Andrew Owen sentenced Joseph Smith to death and said, quote, "Carly endured unspeakable trauma, which began at the time of her kidnapping. The image of the defendant taking her arm and leading her away no doubt will forever be etched in our minds. At 11 years of age, there is no doubt she was aware of her dire predicament and that she had little or no hope of survival. Her death was conscienceless and pitiless, calculated and premeditated. Joseph Smith, based on your actions, you have forfeited your right to live freely among us. May God have mercy on your soul." End quote. As you can imagine, the death of someone has a ripple effect. And when it's as tragic as a case like Carly's, it can really change and alter people's lives. At the sentencing hearing, Carly's mother was not in court because she herself was in jail for drug-related charges. She claimed that she had turned to drugs to cope with the pain and suffering she felt over the loss of her daughter. Carly's grandmother died not long after Carly, and many said that she died from a broken heart. Carly's uncle also died in a singular car accident when his truck struck a tree. It is speculated that he took his own life. Carly's mother would also pass away, unfortunately, from a drug overdose. And again, a lot of people talk about the fact that she turned to drugs because she just couldn't recover from the loss of her daughter. After his sentencing, Joseph Smith filed several appeals, all of which were denied. But his time on death row would soon come to an end. According to Jacksonville.com, in 2016, the U.S. Supreme Court found that Florida's death penalty process was unconstitutional because it gave too much authority to judges instead of juries. The U.S. Supreme Court's decision and subsequent Florida Supreme Court rulings have led the requirements that juries must unanimously agree on critical findings before judges can impose death sentences, and they must unanimously recommend the death penalty. And because the jury in this case voted 10-2 for Joseph to be sentenced to death, he was given a new resentencing trial. Finally, in 2021, Joseph Smith was once again sentenced to death. Carly's father was quoted by Fox 13 saying, quote, "I feel so let down by the system because Joseph Smith was on parole before he got to my daughter, and he was supposed to go back to jail for 5 years if he violated. He did violate. He was passed out with a bag of cocaine in a parking lot. Instead of giving the consequences that they said they would, they gave him drug offender probation, which is just semantics, and that's why my daughter is not here today. Then they drag this thing on from 2005 to 2021, and still it's not done yet. I have a lot of venom and disdain for the criminal justice system." End quote. The place where Carly was found behind the church has now since been turned into a small memorial for her. It's a place where people in the community can go to honor Carly and pray. They call it the Garden of Joy and has a picture of Carly to remind everyone why it was built. McIntosh Middle School also dedicated a garden on their property for Carly. In the years since her murder, the garden has been redone and is home to a bench that reads, "In Memory of Carly Brucia." It's a bright and joyful area with butterfly sculpture, a bench, flowers, and green grass. It brings joy to the many staff members who still work at the school and is a daily reminder of Carly and her joyful spirit. After the conviction of Joseph Smith, prosecutors started to question whether he was involved with other unsolved murders, specifically the murder of Tara Riley. Tara was 25 years old when she was murdered in the year 2000 and found nude in a pond behind a Walmart in Bradenton, a 28-minute drive from Sarasota. In a recorded phone conversation from prison, Tara's name would come up. Joseph's mother and brother John were talking to Joseph, asking him questions, one of which they said, quote, "Did they ask you about Tara?" End quote. What he replied, I do not know, but I do know that it's been reported that Tara Riley had worked with John, and just before her murder, she turned Joseph down when he asked her out. John has admitted that he thought his brother was responsible for Tara's murder, and he had hoped that they'd be able to solve it once and for all, because he said that Tara was a sweet and wonderful person. But unfortunately, Joseph would never get the chance to admit to Tara's murder or stand trial for it. Because in July 2021, 55-year-old Joseph Smith would die in the Union Correctional Institution in Radford, Florida, while on death row. There are differing reports on what caused his death, ranging from he died from cancer, and then others reported it was other illnesses. And honestly, it really doesn't matter. I'm just happy that this POS is dead. The state's attorney, Ed Brodsky, made a statement saying, quote, "While nothing can bring back Carly, we are grateful that her family, her friends, and the entire Sarasota community will finally have closure and will not have to endure any further court proceedings to bring Smith to justice," end quote. And I agree. I am happy that her family does not have to suffer seeing him alive anymore while their sweet Carly is gone. My heart just hurts for this family. The absence of Carly has had such an effect on all of their lives, and even though it's been over 21 years, it all feels so fresh for them. Carly was just 11 years old, so young and so full of life. I have no doubt that she would have gone on and done amazing things. She was a daughter, a sister, a friend, a niece, and those who knew and loved her are forever changed. People in the community are also changed, and Carly will forever be known as Sarasota's little girl. Thank you, everyone, for listening to this week's episode. If you're not already a part of my private Facebook group, you can find it by searching Crime with Holly Podcast Discussion Group. In there, I share all information and pictures pertaining to the cases that I cover, and I also encourage all of my members to share all things true crime. You can also follow me over on Instagram. And if you would like to join the Patreon family, the link is in the description of this episode, or you can visit www.patreon.com/crimewithholly. And for just $2 a month, you can listen to every single episode ad-free. I will be back next week with another all-new episode. Until then, be aware and take care. Bye-bye.